You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
Welcome, everyone, to today's panel. As a part of Women's History Month, you all have a page on your chairs talking about today's panel here at 1 o'clock, and then there's another panel coming up in the same room, so you don't have to remember where to go, at 4 p.m., focusing on reproductive rights in another sense, and that's childbirth and maternity. So something that might be way far down the road in your vision of your life, but at some point most of us will choose to become parents, both men and women. So something I hope you'll come for this informal discussion at 4 o'clock today. All right, so moving back to today's panel, I'm Dr. Lauren Braun-Stromfels in history, and I'm just going to give a very brief introduction, and we'll open it up to the panel. So for most of us, when we hear the phrase reproductive rights and the Supreme Court, we always think of what? Exactly, abortion, Roe versus Wade, probably, I would say, maybe one of the most well-known, if not the most well-known Supreme Court case in, you know, among the entire American public. So this case, though, is not where we're going to start today. And the purpose, one of the purposes of this panel is to help us extend and expand our understanding of what reproductive rights mean in the context of United States history, and also to think about the different ways in which our ability to control our own bodies has been regulated over time and challenged in the Supreme Court. So we're going to have three separate cases considered today. The first will be Buck versus Bell from 1927, presented by Professor Karen Gaffney. We'll follow that up with Professor Barbara Cedar, who will be presenting birth control. And then finally, our blockbuster case presented by Professor Maria DeFilippis, who is also a lawyer, will be discussing the implications of Roe versus Wade from 1973. So we hope to have a lively discussion afterwards, so think about questions you might want to ask, and now I'll turn it over to Professor Gaffney.
Thank you so much. I apologize, I'm a little hoarse, so bear with me. So I'm going to focus on the case Buck v. Bell. You're likely not familiar with it. I mean, we'd raise your hand if you've heard of this Supreme Court case before. Okay, so that's fine. That's good. We'll start from scratch. Okay, so you may or may not be familiar with the eugenics movement, and understanding that is the key to understanding this particular Supreme Court case. So I do want to spend a little bit of time helping you understand that, and whatever questions you have, we can certainly talk through that. So essentially, eugenics was a movement that started in the late 1800s and evolved into the early 1900s in the U.S., but also in Europe. And the basic focus was on white racial purity. Okay, and this broke down into a couple of different ways. So positive eugenics meant encouraging the propagation and breeding of families perceived to have quote-unquote good genes. So this meant middle class and wealthy, quote-unquote pure white people having lots and lots of children. There were contests called the Fitter Family Contest at different state fairs, where families would literally be judged for the purity of their racial characteristics. Okay, so that's on the one hand encouraging the supposed good families to have more children. The flip side, of course, is what they call negative eugenics, and that is essentially stopping the propagation of families considered to have supposedly bad genes. So this would include anybody who wasn't white, immigrants, the poor, you name it. It's a wide, wide range of people. And one of the things that became used is a term called feeble-mindedness. Now, we might today just throw around the word feeble-minded just to mean, you know, dumb or stupid or something like that, but it's important to understand that at the time, this label had a lot of power. If you were labeled officially by the state as feeble-minded, you essentially lost a lot of your rights and your power. The problem, of course, is that the label feeble-minded ultimately has absolutely no medical and no scientific basis. Okay? But at the time, it was given the highest authority. Okay, so eugenics was ultimately supported by scientists, by doctors, by lawyers, by politicians, by journalists, by artists, by all kinds of people in the mainstream culture. This is not a fringe movement. This is mainstream American culture in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And again, this notion of feeble-mindedness was at the heart of this this definition. Okay. So we're going to jump specifically to the year 1924. And I just want to give you a little bit of background information, and then we're going to go specifically to Virginia. So on the national stage, though, Congress passed the Immigration Act of 1924. And basically, this said that immigration was highly valued if you were from Northern Europe. Everyone else on the whole planet essentially had to step aside, okay? So Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, immigration was highly discouraged, okay? Not to mention everywhere else, all right? So there was a concern about rising immigration from Italy, from all different parts of Europe and other areas. So one method of control and one method of attempting to increase a supposedly white racial population was to cut back on immigration. However, the concern is, well, what do we do about everybody who's already here? Okay, and Virginia had some pretty scary answers to that question. So also in 1924, at the same time, no less, Virginia passed two really important laws. One was the Racial Integrity Act, and basically this mandated an attempt to be very careful and precise at labeling one's race at birth. And again, this is just not scientifically possible, not biologically, not medically possible, but there was this real attempt to label people. And on top of that, there was, as part of this law, there was the notion that whites could not marry anyone who wasn't white. And when they said white, they meant 100% white. Again, that's a meaningless definition, but it's all about labeling and ultimately sort of categorizing people. At the same time, in the same session, I believe, Virginia also passed the Sterilization Act, which allowed for the involuntary sterilization of anybody who was labeled feeble-minded. Again, involuntary, without consent, and sometimes without knowledge of anybody who, again, was labeled feeble-minded, which, as I mentioned before, is a label that was used essentially to define anybody who is perceived as sort of not fitting in appropriately. Okay. Oops. I don't know why is this changing. Is this okay here? I don't know what's going on. We're not not doing any sound here. Okay, so enter Carrie Buck. Okay, she was born in Virginia in 1906. A little bit of background on her. Her mother, Emma, was institutionalized at what they called the Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. Okay, so again, if you were diagnosed as epileptic, you were also considered as somebody who needs to be separated from society and not supposed to have any children, and you needed to be sequestered. Okay, so Emma was institutionalized at this facility for supposed prostitution. Her daughter, Carrie, ended up in foster care. At a foster home, and in this foster home, she was forced to stop attending school when she was only in sixth grade because she wasn't getting enough of her chores done for the foster family. Okay, so she was working full-time in a foster care situation when she was only in sixth grade. At 17, she was raped by a member of the foster family. And instead of addressing that in a way that we would think is appropriate, the family institutionalized her at the same colony where her mother was in order to cover up the rape and protect the rapist in the family. So she was sent to, again, the same colony where her mother was institutionalized. All right. So we're in 1924 in Virginia. The sterilization of those labeled feeble-minded has just been passed. And here we have Carrie Buck, who has just been identified as feeble-minded because she had a baby outside of wedlock, again, against her will. And she is now at the moment where they need a test case. Okay, so those who support this sterilization law want to be able to expand it and reinforce its power. And so they want to be able to take it to the Supreme Court. They consider Carrie an ideal test case. So her guardian, somebody who's supposed to be there to support her, was told to appeal the sterilization, and also ultimately the lawyer that was hired by the guardian to theoretically fight on her behalf was also in cahoots with everybody supporting the law. So ultimately, Carrie Buck really had nobody in the legal world on her side here. So everyone, regardless of which side they were on, were really trying to reinforce the power of this sterilization law to make sure that Carrie would be sterilized, again, against her will and without her consent. So as I mentioned, her guardian was told to appeal the sterilization so that this new Virginia law could be tested at the level of the Supreme Court and presumably upheld. Another important reason why this was considered an ideal case is because of Carrie's mother and Carrie's daughter. So they now had supposed proof that feeble-mindedness was hereditary. Okay, so they have a mother who's been institutionalized, her daughter, and then her daughter. Of course, again, the reasons for these institutionalizations, you know, are more than suspect. All right, and ultimately I'll mention that the youngest child here, who unfortunately died of measles when she was still in elementary or middle school, but by the time she was in school, she was on the honor roll. Okay, so again, intelligence is ultimately not related to this. Okay, it's about power, and I think you'll see that very shortly. Okay, so as the case was being fought, I have a couple of quotes that relate to the sort of testimony being used to support the sterilization of Carrie and anybody else labeled feeble-minded. So one person said, "These people belong to the shiftless, ignorant, and moving class of antisocial whites of the South." Okay? So their crime is being poor. Another quote referred to Carrie's social and economic inadequacy. Again, being poor. They referred to her record during her life of immorality, prostitution, and untruthfulness, has never been self-sustaining, has had one illegitimate child, again, which was because of a rape. Okay? So again, think about sort of the power dynamics going on here. Ultimately, this law passed with a majority vote at the Supreme Court level in 1927, 8-1. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, who you may have heard of, wrote the majority opinion, again, mandating for the sterilization of Carrie Buck and anyone else labeled feeble-minded. And I want to read a couple of the statements that he gave in support of her sterilization. Carrie Buck is the probable potential parent of socially inadequate offspring, likewise afflicted, that she may be sexually sterilized without detriment to her general health and that her welfare and that of society will be promoted by her sterilization. Okay? And then finally, it is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough. And again, this is the language of the majority decision at the level of the Supreme Court. This is not a fringe movement. This is the heart of our power structure. Okay, and ultimately, Carrie Buck is being penalized for being poor and for having been raped. So what happened? Okay, so once the Supreme Court gave a go-ahead to this sterilization law, 29 states across the country, if they hadn't already, they started to carry out involuntary sterilizations. By 1940, more than 35,000 men and women, so it's not just women, this is men too. By 1940, more than 35,000 men and women had been sterilized involuntarily, again, without their consent. And I'll also point out that the law that was created in Virginia was ultimately used as a model for the Nazis in the years leading up to the Holocaust. They found that this law was exactly the kind of thing they wanted to do in Nazi Germany and looked to Virginia as the model here. I'll also mention that in 2002, Virginia officially apologized for these actions, and the governor, Governor Mark Warner, said that the Commonwealth's sincere apology for Virginia's participation in eugenics, and he also said that the eugenics movement was a shameful effort in which state government never should have been involved. And they erected a plaque, a memorial, near the birthplace of Carrie Buck. One might ask, you know, is that enough? But I figured I would share that with you. I'm going to stop there. And you probably have some questions, but I'm just going to ask you to save those questions until we get through the other cases. And I think ultimately you'll probably see some connections between these cases, but I'm happy to, you know, if you want to find out more about this, there's some really excellent resources. There's a lot of work that's been done on this. We have some of these books in the library. There's some amazing websites that really go through this history. I just gave you a tiny, tiny little slice of this. So I'm going to, we're going to move on to Professor Barbara Cedar. Thank you. Do you need help setting up?
I'm going to have to.
Okay.
I'm going to put this one in. Do you have audio?
No, I don't need audio.
Talk to you today about birth control, something I think so many of us just assume is one of our natural rights to possess birth control, to limit the number of children that we might want. Certainly, we've had governments that have suggested to us that we should limit the number of children we have. Again, building on what Karen had to say, if you're poor in this country, we certainly want you to limit the number of children that you can have. So we need to kind of begin, tethered to this, with the birth control movement. And it really begins with the purity movement, which I think is kind of interesting now because we have a new purity movement where we want young people to maintain their virginity and so forth. It's under a different guise, but the purity movement developed in the United States in the 1860s. It was not unique to the United States. The same type of movement was occurring across Europe. It was a Christian movement, and it basically said we need to operate on Christian principles. So their first target was prostitution. Now, I think many of us who are feminists, many of us who are not Christians, also, though, believe that we want to address issues of prostitution. So we don't want to necessarily say this is a bad movement. Some of the things they were concerned about, setting the age of consent. And certainly I think that's relevant today. We don't want people having sex with young children and saying, but they consented. Okay, censoring pornography. Kind of mixed on that one. Unsegregating prisons. For a time, men and women went to the same prisons. And of course, in Women's History Month, we want to think about all those women who were victimized by men, who were raped and abused because they were in non-sex segregated prisons. But over time, they add on abortion and birth control. So that one of the first societies, and this is Anthony Comstock, he finds the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. Now, he starts out as just a clerk, devout clerk, and some of his fellow employees are found reading obscene materials. He is outraged, and so he goes on a crusade. We need to go around the state. We need to make local authorities prosecute these people, confiscate these materials. So he leads this fight against gambling. Boy, the NFL would hate that. Prostitution and detestable books and pamphlets. Now, these kind of euphemisms are really dangerous because what is detestable? Okay. Well, how many of you read Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales? Okay. Was it detestable? Might have been hard to read, but I don't think detestable fits it. But these are the kind of books and pamphlets that end up being banned also. But where he really takes his attack is let's get rid of those books on birth control or those pamphlets because this is obscene material. Very dissatisfied that local authorities and local laws do not have enough meat, enough muscle to confiscate, to prosecute. So he goes on a crusade and he urges Congress. Now he gets on his side, a number of the churches, including the Catholic Church that supports him. He gets on his side, the YMCA becomes supporters of his. And they go to Congress and say, you have to pass legislation. And so they pass the Comstock Act. It's known as the Act of the Suppression of Trade-in and the Circulation of Obscene Literature and Articles of Immoral Use. Congress certainly can be wordy. It criminalized publication, distribution, and possession about information or devices or medications for unlawful abortion or contraception. Not just abortion, but contraception. The fines were great. 5 years imprisonment. That's significant. And a fine of up to $2,000. Okay. Now this is more than a century ago, so think about the weight of this fine. If you sent the material through the mail, though, the fines were more than doubled. So what were some of the impediments in the 20th century for getting birth control? I mean, how does this come about? Well, first you had the state laws. And as Karen pointed out, In Virginia, you have a state law permitting sterilizations. So you have across the country these state laws. The Comstock law effectively banned birth control information and devices across the board. Another concern, though, was the lack, and I think many of us can understand this, many people were concerned about the lack of any kind of oversight on the effectiveness of contraception. I don't know about you, but when I was younger, I wanted the stuff to work, and I'm sure many of you do too. And there was no oversight of this. There was a declining birth rate. Now, this is interesting because it ties into what Karen was saying. The declining birth rate was among the white middle class. The declining birth rate wasn't among poor people. So this, the kind of concerns that motivated the immigration acts that had national origins, we didn't want those people coming. These were the same kind of acts that that led to, maybe we can't control birth, particularly for the upper classes. And then there was a lack of medical research on birth control. So doctors didn't have information. Who do you go to when you want information in the past on birth control? Your physician. But since there was no medical research being done on contraceptives, most doctors didn't know anything about contraceptives. So along comes Margaret Sanger. And I'm not going to debate Margaret Sanger right now. I mean, there are many critics who argue that some of her work promoted the eugenics movement, that some of it was very racist in tone. Certainly some of her motivations were anti-working class. But that's something to discuss at another time. She used to go around and tell this tale of Sadie Sachs. And I'll explain to you why I call it a tale. Sadie Sachs, she was working as a nurse, and she had to treat this woman who had 5 or 6 children already, and she was suffering from a self-induced abortion. Sanger treats her, and the woman, Sadie, begs her to please help her so she doesn't have more children. There's nothing that Margaret Sanger can do. She can just treat her for the botched, self-inflicted abortion. She discovers a year later or so that the woman died again from an unplanned pregnancy. And she claimed that this is what motivated her. Now, why I call it a tale is that we really can't find historical documented evidence that Sadie Sachs existed. And so many of her biographers argue that she really culled Sadie Sachs from a number of women that she tended to as a nurse. So in 1914, she founded the National Birth Control League, and she publishes The Woman Rebel, Family Limitation. That's really quite radical at the time. And then in 1916, she opened the first birth control clinic in the United States. And this led to her arrest for the distribution of information on contraception. Okay. So the first case, that case ends up being dismissed. But she wants to challenge the law. And people want to challenge the law, not just merely because it might impact on their lives, but because there are broader issues. So what she does is she orders a diaphragm, kind of a revolutionary new form of birth control from Japan. Under the Comstock law, it was seized and confiscated. The lower court and the appellate court rule against the government. They say you can't do that. A doctor prescribed this, you can't do this. Government appeals to the Supreme Court. And this is what Augustus Noble Pan wrote. While it's true that the policy of Congress has been to forbid the use of contraceptives altogether, if the only purpose in using them is to prevent contraception, in cases where it would not be injurious to the welfare of the patient or her offspring, it is going far beyond such a policy to hold that abortions, which destroy incipient life, may be allowed in the proper cases, and yet no measures may be taken to prevent contraception, even though a likely result should be to require the termination of pregnancy by means of an abortion. So he's saying, how can you punish women for an abortion and needing an abortion if you don't provide them with a method of avoiding pregnancy, particularly if health is involved? It seems unreasonable to suppose that the national scheme of legislation involves such inconsistencies that require the complete suppression of articles, the use of which in many cases is advocated by such a weight of authority in the medical world. So what this did is it exempted doctors, physicians from the Comstock law on the dissemination of information. Okay. So we get to two other cases. Now these cases are interesting because again we have advocates who want to challenge state laws. Now in fairness, state laws weren't always applied. And that might be a good thing, that might be a bad thing. A good thing if you're able to circumvent the state law. A bad thing if someone won't circumvent it for you. You want birth control and it's not available. So there were two cases. There was the Tylston versus Ullman and the Poe versus Ullman cases. Tylston was a well-respected physician from Harvard. And he put together three cases of women whose health would be in danger if they were forced to carry a pregnancy to term. So he's arguing on medical grounds. And what the Supreme Court did is they dismissed his case. They said, you don't have standing. You're not hurt by this. So Poe and his patients bring suit. And again, the Supreme Court says, we're not going to handle the case. We're not going to hear it. It's not right. It's not ready. No one can really prove that they've been hurt by this. So that's something to think about with the Supreme Court, because we often hear people say, I'm going to take that to the Supreme Court. Most likely, no, you're not, because the Supreme Court decides what it will hear and what it won't hear, what types of cases it wants to hear, where it might want to look at precedent set, but where it might want to set precedent. But the first case they get forced to take involves a Connecticut law. The law prohibited the use of any drug, medical article, or instrument for the purposes of preventing conception. Now, Griswold had opened up a clinic in New Haven, Connecticut, where she partially opened up the clinic, both to provide contraception and information, but also to be arrested, to be able to have standing to challenge the law. Because now someone will have been hurt. She was arrested, she was fined, she was found guilty and fined. She was ordered to pay $100 each. She also had a co-owner of the clinic, and he was also ordered to pay $100. So the conviction was upheld by the Appellate Division of the Circuit Court and by the Connecticut Supreme Court. The U.S. court has to take, the Supreme Court has to take the case, or they decide to take the case, because now somebody has been hurt. Griswold, she has to pay a fine. So they vote by 7-2 that the statute is invalid. Okay? And I want you to look at this. It violated the right to marital privacy. Now, Maria is going to talk about privacy in the next case, but here's where the court begins setting down, do we have some privacy in our lives? But what's important is the right to privacy. So how many of you in this room are not married? Okay. Now, I'm not going to ask you how many of you are having sex or not, but how many of you who are not married, I don't really want to know. How many of you who are not married think you should have the right to obtain birth control and use birth control? Okay. This decision doesn't go that far. It says within the privacy of marriage, okay, marital privacy. Okay, I'm going to just move on. So they use the 14th Amendment, and they argue essentially, also the 9th Amendment, but I'm not going to get into that, that no state shall make or enforce any law that shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person the equal protections of the law. Such an important amendment, the 14th Amendment. There were two dissenters, and the two dissenters argued that since privacy is not in the Constitution, there is no mention of privacy, that the other justices were stretching. There is no, they argue, no constitutional right to privacy. Okay. The next case that I think is important is the Baird case, because Baird went around the country going to universities and giving lectures on birth control. Now, this was in 1967 that he gets arrested. Some of us in this room were just coming of age at that time, off to college and so forth. And so he gives a package of contraceptive foam to a young woman at Boston College, and he's arrested. He's arrested under the Massachusetts laws, crimes against chastity. Contraceptives could be distributed only by pharmacists or doctors and only to to married persons. Okay. Again, the Supreme Court here ruled that unmarried persons have the right to engage in potentially non-procreative sexual intercourse. I do want to do a little aside on this. You'll notice that it doesn't give you the right to engage in all kinds of intercourse. So if you happen to be gay, Einstein versus Baird is not going to protect you. And of course, what we saw in Bowers is it didn't protect you. It only referred to heterosexual couples and non-procreative sex. So where are we today? Okay. Where are we? Well, yes, we'd think the battle's won, right? The battle is run. It's over. No, it's not. For those of you who have to buy health care, for those of you who may get health care from your employer, there are two cases right now before the Supreme Court. Holly Hobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties. And these two companies that are not a little family-owned company, as I'd like you to believe. This is a chain, okay? They would like you to believe that they're just a nice little old family-owned company, and, you know, they're really religious, and so why should they, under the Affordable Care Act, have to provide you with access to contraception? Okay. So I'd like to kind of leave that hanging out there and come back to it during the question and answer period. Your thoughts on that? Okay.
All right. Hello, everyone. I'm Maria DeFilippis. As Professor Braun mentioned, I'm an attorney. I coordinate the paralegal studies program here at the college, and I'm here to talk to you about abortion rights and the U.S. Supreme Court opinion Roe versus Wade. So let's just see if this will... Oh, it didn't work. Ah.
This is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
I don't know how to lower this.
Good evening. The landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia.
Oops. That didn't work. I don't know how to lower this. I'm very sorry. There should be a volume thing here, but it's not working. Mic. Let's try it again.
This is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. Good evening. The landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government. Thus...
Whoops.
Did we lose it?
You stopped it.
Oh, how did that happen? Sorry.
Well, okay. You get the idea. Sorry it was so loud. But anyway, on January 22, 1973, the United States Supreme Court decided the infamous case of Roe versus Wade.
Now, the decision was controversial when it was released, and it remains one of the most intensely debated Supreme Court opinions today, even over 40 years later. So, we have people on both sides. Conservatives and liberals are trying to overturn Roe versus Wade. This decision and women's abortion rights lie in the balance. And the balance I'm talking about and the balance that this cartoon displays is balancing the meaning of what the Supreme Court actually said in the case of Roe versus Wade. So, what was the decision? What did the Supreme Court say? When Professor Braun mentioned it, you all said, Roe, Roe, Roe. So you all know what it means, right? Yes? You know what it means? Well, let's see if you do or not. Take out your cell phones. And I want you to answer this for me. What exactly did the Supreme Court say in Roe versus Wade? Come on, take out your phones. This is a quiz. A, B, or C? Come on, we got to have some people texting. Come on. No, nobody's doing this, or is anybody not there yet?
Not there yet.
All right. They only get like 15 minutes, so you have to hurry. We got four, no more than four. Anybody else doing this? Come on. Ten. 11. There's a lot more than 11 of you, and you all have smartphones. Come on. See a couple of people still trying. Is that it? We're only going to get 14 of you? All right. All right. Oops. Oh, come on. Why am I having so much trouble getting this to work? All right, I can't get the results to show. There they are. There. All right. So, two of you answered that the first one was what the decision said, that the states could not ban abortions. Well, you would be wrong. Roe does not stop states from banning abortions. In fact, under some circumstances, the court opinion says states can, and almost all states do, ban abortions under certain circumstances. Five of you picked that a woman's right to choose was protected by the Constitution. No, again. The Roe case and the Constitution have nothing to do with a woman's right to choose. And the last one, a woman has a qualified privacy right to terminate her pregnancy. The majority of you, seven of you, said yes, and this is the correct answer. Hooray! The Roe case does say that a woman has a right to privacy. It's not an absolute right, though. It's a qualified right, and it only remains hers and hers alone, as Walter Cronkite said in the video I played, during the first trimester of the pregnancy. Then it's an unqualified right. After that, a woman has, there are other interests that are involved besides a woman's privacy rights to an abortion. So, I want to show you just a little bit, talk a little bit about the history of the case. So this is Norma McCorvey. It's about 15 years after the Roe versus Wade case was decided. And in 1969, Norma was 21 years old. She lived in Dallas, Texas. She was divorced and pregnant for the third time. She got married when she was 16, and she had her first child was adopted by her mother. Her second child was given up for private adoption. And when she got pregnant a third time, she went to a clinic because she was a poor person, and she said she wanted an abortion. And the clinic doctors told her that, unfortunately, we can't give you an abortion because Texas law only allows an abortion for the purpose of saving the life of the mother, right? And since it wasn't a life-saving situation, if they gave her an abortion, they would be criminals and they would go to jail. So she said, what can I do? And they sent her, these clinic doctors, to two attorneys, women attorneys, Sarah Waddington and Linda Coffey. And those attorneys agreed to file a lawsuit. In the lawsuit, they gave Norma a pseudonym, Jane Roe, to protect her identity. And then the Dallas County District Attorney was named Wade, Attorney Wade, and hence, if you'll excuse the pun, the case of Roe versus Wade was born, okay? Anyway, the case was a class action lawsuit, which means Norma, or Jane Roe, was representing all pregnant women in the state of Texas, and they were arguing or challenging the constitutionality of Texas abortion law, right? Roe's side argued, or the plaintiffs, that this Texas law denied women their right to privacy. Professor Sita was talking about the right to privacy, which was first recognized by the court in Griswold when they said married people can get contraceptives. It's the right of privacy. They're allowed to make those private decisions under the 14th Amendment. And the state, Mr. Wade, was arguing that the right of the unborn child is superior to the privacy right of the pregnant woman. And it was the state's purpose or obligation to represent the rights of that unborn fetus. So you get the two sides here, right? What each side was saying. So the court, faced with these two arguments, had to make a decision, and this is what the court held. I get some great pictures here. This is actually the Supreme Court when they announced the decision. Can you see the people were handing out fetuses and little... Do you see that in the picture, in the top picture? And then, of course, these are people marching for and against abortion at the time. Anyway, so the court decided that laws like Texas, the statute they had in front of them, which allowed an abortion only to save the mother's life, violated a woman's right to privacy because people have a right to be free of state, undue state intervention. And the court said, but the state does have some obligations and interests here, too. And these interests, like the mom's health, like the status of the unborn fetus, these interests get bigger and bigger at certain stages in the pregnancy. And from that sort of argument, the trimester rule was born. Do you all know the trimester rule in the Supreme Court, right? It was used to balance the state's rights and the pregnant woman's right to privacy. And basically, it said you can break a pregnancy into three stages or trimesters. In the first third of it, the first 3 months, the abortion decision, as Walter Cronkite said in the first video, belongs to the woman and her doctor. It's her absolute privilege to make a decision in the first trimester. After that, and you know, subsequent to that, the state has the right to promote the health of the mother, and it can make reasonable regulations on abortion after that in the second and third trimester in order to protect the mother's rights in the second trimester. In the final trimester, the rights of the states are even bigger because now we have a fetus who might be viable outside the womb. And viability is defined by the case as able to live outside the womb even if with some artificial help. So do you get how the court's looking at it? We got three parts. First part, all belongs to the woman. Middle part, state might be able to have some rules to protect the mom's health. Last part, you got a fetus that might be viable, the state can have even more restrictions, okay? So that's all the court said. Does this seem unreasonable to any of you? Does it? I mean, does it seem so outrageous and so phenomenally unbelievable? I tell you that I don't think it's crazy. But the bottom line was, at the time that this case was decided, 46 states had laws that made abortions criminal under most every circumstance, unless it had to do with mom's health or rape or incest, but 46 out of 50 states. So the question at the end of this case is, or for the judges in this case, in the Supreme Court was, what do these 46 states do? We have to give them some guidance, right? So the court developed what they called the strict scrutiny standard. And they basically said, if a state has an abortion law, makes abortion illegal or whatever the law says, in order for that law to be constitutional, not to violate the 14th Amendment privacy right, it had to have a compelling government interest, it had to be very narrowly tailored so it just met that interest, and it had to be the least restrictive way to meet that interest. This was a very strong or strict test, not an easy one to meet, right? So we go along, and this comes out, and again, as I said, 46 out of 50 states have to change their abortion law. So even though all the court said was, let's divide into three parts, right, this case had a huge legal impact. 46 states had to rewrite their laws. That's a lot of legal impact, right? But well beyond the legal impact was the social and political impact. That was even greater, right? Immediately, groups and factions developed either against the law or in favor of it. People who wanted to degrade the decision, people who wanted to promote the decision, pro-life and pro-choice labels were born, right? And anybody here never hear of pro-life or pro-choice? No, 40 years later, these are the labels we're still using, right, to talk about abortion. So anyway, some of the groups that, you know, came out of this decision, in the 60s and 70s when this case was heard, the feminist movement and sexual revolution was in its heyday. And so those groups really embraced Roe versus Wade, right? Planned Parenthood exists as a result of Roe versus Wade. I don't know, when I was in college, we couldn't use contraceptives till the very end under the Griswold case and the Baird case, but at any rate, you know, Planned Parenthood came about because of Roe versus Wade. On the flip side, a lot of Christian and religious organizations formed to specifically to oppose Roe versus Wade. Have you heard of the March for Life? It happens every year for the last 41 years on January 22nd. Goes to D.C. It's estimated the most recent numbers I could get was the 2012 march, that over 500,000 people marched in the March for Life, again, opposing Roe versus Wade and abortion. Presidents and governors, they made their decision. They used Roe as the litmus test on deciding whether or not they would nominate someone for a judgeship, whether it was in the state court or in the Supreme Court. They said, how do you feel about Roe? You want to overturn it? Okay, you're my man or woman. You don't want to overturn it? Okay, right? Depending on how they felt about Roe, governors and presidents appointed judges using Roe as a litmus test. Unheard of with any other case decided by the court. State legislatures also then got into the act. They began to try to test the impact and the reach of Roe by passing laws that had restrictions on abortion, arguing that, yeah, we put a restriction on, but it meets the strict scrutiny test, so this law is okay, right? This went on for 20 years. And then finally, in 1992, the opposers to Roe thought they had the case that was going to do the trick, that was going to overturn Roe versus Wade and get rid of the concept of a woman's right to abortion. So the case was Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and it was out of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania legislature passed laws in 1988, I think it was, that restricted abortion. And it put certain kinds of restrictions on. One is informed consent. Women couldn't have an abortion unless she got all the material about all the dangers. The other was a 24-hour waiting period. After you got informed, you had to wait 24 hours before you could have an abortion. The third was if you were a minor who wanted an abortion, then you needed the consent of at least one parent. And then if you were a married woman wanting an abortion, you had to get your husband, your spouse, to sign a notification form that he knew you were getting an abortion. And then they put a bunch of restrictions on hospitals and clinics. So Planned Parenthood, actually five different clinics, and a group of doctors who provided abortion services both at the clinics and in their private practice, sued the state of Pennsylvania, represented by Casey, who was then the district attorney for the state, arguing that the restrictions in the Pennsylvania law didn't meet the strict scrutiny standard of Roe and therefore were unconstitutional, right? Now, at this point, you have to understand the Supreme Court had a lot more conservative people on it. President Reagan had appointed people who were anti-Roe. Scalia was on the court. Very different court than when the case was Roe case was decided in 1973. So 20 years later, we have a much more conservative Supreme Court. So the conservatives who are anti-Roe think this will be the case where they throw Roe out. Well, it didn't work. It was a very close decision, though, 5-4. The justices upheld Roe. They said it's still the law of the United States, but we're going to change it a little, right? Instead of that strict scrutiny standard, we're going to impose an undue burden. So now they tell all the states in the Planned Parenthood case that if you have a law, it just can't create an undue burden on a woman's right to have an abortion before viability, before the fetus can live outside the womb, right? So using that test, when they applied it to the restrictions in Pennsylvania's case, what do you think? Did all the restrictions pass? Anybody know? They all passed except one. You want to take a guess which one? Notification of the husband. That's the only one that failed. So all the other restrictions, informed consent, waiting period, minors, they all passed. The only one that failed the undue burden test was having to notify your husband that you were going to have an abortion. So now what? States are given a green light. Go ahead and put these restrictions on your abortion laws. It doesn't violate the Constitution. It doesn't undermine Roe versus Wade. So that's what happened. 40 years later, we're still testing abortion rights, and we're still putting restrictions on a woman's privacy right to make the decision to have an abortion. And these are just a sample of the kinds of restrictions out there. The first one, hospital and physician requirements. 39 states, including New Jersey, require that abortions be performed only by a licensed physician. There are many who argue that there are other people who deal in maternity, like physician assistants and midwife, that's what went in my head, midwives who are just as competent as physicians, but the law in 39 states, including ours, requires that it's only a licensed physician who can perform an abortion. 20 states require that they can be performed only in a hospital after a certain period in the pregnancy. New Jersey is one of them, and New Jersey says if it's more than 14 weeks, you can only have your abortion in a hospital. And then 18 states require a second physician okay the abortion, right? So what does this restriction have the effect of? It costs more now, it takes more time. Who's going to be disproportionately affected by these kinds of restrictions? Poor and underprivileged women, exactly. We've heard that in all three speakers. That's who gets the most effect from these kinds of laws. The second one, gestational limits, are 41 states prohibit abortions after a certain point, usually viability of the fetus, then you can't have it. New Jersey's not one. The third one, partial birth, 19 states prohibit partial birth abortions, make them illegal. 17 states, including New Jersey, allow for some public funding of abortions. New Jersey allows state Medicaid funds to be used. 32 states, though, prohibit it. So 17 yay, 32 say no, you can't use your Medicaid to have an abortion. Insurance coverage in 8 states, insurance companies are not allowed to cover abortion costs unless it's the life of the mother is at stake. 46 states allow individuals, and 43 allow institutions to refuse to commit abortions. That's F, the refusal one. Refuse to do abortions. New Jersey restricts, New Jersey's one of them. New Jersey says individuals who have a religious belief are allowed to refuse to do an abortion. But as far as institutions, New Jersey says only private or religious institutions can refuse. A public institution cannot refuse to do an abortion. State-mandated counseling, 17 states mandate counseling before abortion. You have to tell the woman things about the link between abortion and cancer, about the ability of a fetus to feel pain, about long-term mental health consequences like depression on the women, etc. And state laws actually require that type of counseling before you're allowed to have an abortion or decide to have an abortion. Waiting periods, 26 states require women to wait 24 hours between the time they're counseled and the procedure. 9 states require that you make 2 separate counseling trips and then the procedure. So what are you saying again? 3 times before you can decide to have your abortion. To me, the most invasive is the ultrasound. There are currently 7 states that require a pregnant woman to undergo an ultrasound and be offered the opportunity to view the ultrasound before making a decision on whether or not to have an abortion. And then parental involvement. 39 states require some parental involvement. Most of them, like 21, say you have to have one or both parents' consent. 13 say you have to notify one or both parents. And 5 of them say parents have to both consent and be notified. So again, these are the current restrictions that we have in this country on a woman's right to have an abortion. So, I know this one's not easy to read. I don't usually like to read my slides, but in case you're interested, by age 45, about half of American women will have an unintended pregnancy, and about 1 in 3 will have an abortion. 45% of people who have never been married constitute the women who are having abortions. 29% of people living together, 15% of married people have abortions in this country. As far as a racial breakdown, 36% are white, 30% black, 25% Hispanic, and the rest other. Of the people who have abortions, 69% are economically disadvantaged. 6 in 10 already have a child. 58% are in their 20s. 88% have their abortion within the first 12 weeks, which is that first trimester when the right belongs solely to the woman. And 73% admit to a religious affiliation and still have an abortion. So that's where the numbers are. And if you think, you know, took 20 years to get to the case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which changed it and made an easier burden to restrict abortion. 20 years later, we're still fighting this, and we're still putting restrictions. And in case you think this isn't happening in your lifetime, you should know that over the last 3 years, 2011 to 2013, 205 restrictions have been placed by the states on the right to have an abortion. 22 states last year in 2013 enacted 70 restrictions on abortion. So, we don't criminalize abortion anymore. We just make it more costly and more difficult to have one. Now we get to my opinion. Overall, I think the trend is in this country not to value the reproductive decisions that a woman makes about herself. In my opinion, women need access to legal medical procedures, and they have to have the right to decide on their own without undue pressure whether or not they're ready to have a child. To me, it's a woman's health issue, both physical and mental health. And I just want to ask you, don't you think it's time to get rid of the labels and start working together to protect women's health? That's it. Although I want to ask you, who knows what happened to Jane Roe or Norma McCorvey? Anybody? She had her baby well before the Supreme Court decided her case and put it up for adoption, in case you're interested. That's it.